This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, February 9, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. As the new interim government takes shape in Iraq, we hear from the likely candidate for prime minister. While Donald Rumsfeld may attempt to normalize relations with China, some lawmakers want to repeal trade with that country. And over 1,000 people gather in support of Ward Churchill at the University of Colorado. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Neil Abram with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Subway workers in Buenos Aires went on strike today, shutting down all five of the city's transit lines. Matt Goldin reports.
Subway workers began their demand for a 53% pay raise last November. They are also protesting the installation of automatic ticket machines. The workers are opposed to the automatic machines because they eliminate jobs and reduce personal customer service. After 4 days of partial strikes lasting 4 hours, the subway workers called today for a strike of 24 hours, reflecting the hardening of the conflict and creating transportation problems for more than 740,000 passengers who use the service each day. The underground strike has caused traffic snarls and large queues at bus stops. Metrovías, the private firm which runs the subway lines, has only offered an 8% increase in wages. The work minister called today for a new meeting with the workers and the company to try to finish this conflict. Reporting for Free Speech Radio News, this is Matt Goldin from Buenos Aires, Argentina.
The White House now says that the prescription drug provision to Medicare they sold to Congress will actually cost taxpayers 3 times as much as originally projected. Candice Fulgano reports from Washington, D.C.
Figures released yesterday from the White House revealed that the true cost of the Medicare prescription drug benefit will be approximately $1.2 trillion over the next decade. This is in contrast to the $534 billion that the Bush administration originally told Congress was needed to fund the program. Mark Weisbrot, coordinator of the Center of Policy and Economic Research, believes people are spending the majority of their income on private health care and the costs are spilling over into the Medicare system.
Healthcare costs are completely out of control. And in fact, if you look at any projections into the future, they're not believable at all. You would end up with, you know, people spending the majority of their income on healthcare.
According to some Democrats, the discrepancy in the Medicare budget shows that Medicare may pose a far more serious budgetary problem in the upcoming decade than other administration concerns, such as the solvency of Social Security. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Candice Fulgencio.
The United Nations Security Council is working on a resolution that would allow the U.N. to send about 10,000 peacekeeping troops to Sudan. Heather Rizvi is in New York.
Currently, the African Union is doing the job of peacekeeping in the Darfur region, but U.N. officials say the number of troops deployed by the African nations are not enough. At this point, it's not clear which countries will be willing to contribute their troops. The ethnic war in Sudan has taken more than 2 million human lives and it has uprooted about 4 million people over the past 20 years. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Heather Rizvi at the United Nations.
27 members of the House of Representatives today introduced a bill to bring the troops home from Iraq that they hope will invigorate discussion about exit strategies and spending priorities. Jenny Johnson has more.
Through the introduction of the legislation, Representative Lynn Woolsey, Democrat of California, the bill's sponsor, is pressuring the House International Relations Committee to hold hearings to develop an exit strategy. Until now, lawmakers have not proposed troop withdrawal. This shift may be due in part to the success of the Iraq elections, which demonstrated the preparedness of Iraqis to manage their own affairs, according to Woolsey.
The Iraq elections didn't vindicate the doctrine of preemptive war. They actually demonstrated that Iraqis can and should take care of their own destinies.
Another event that makes the legislation timely is the expected request from the administration for $80 billion to cover war costs. Representative Barbara Lee, Democrat of California, explains.
We know that the president's going to ask for another $80 billion. So far, we don't even know what is included in this $80 billion. I would hope that this $80 billion really sets the stage for this exit strategy to bring our young men and women home.
Jenny Johnson, Free Speech Radio News.
We'll have more on developments in Iraq later in the newscast. Wearing low pants in Virginia could be considered a crime if some Virginia legislators have their way. Selena Masuda is with the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Anyone in Virginia caught wearing low-riding pants that expose their underwear could face a $50 fine if a bill proposed by Democrat Delegate Algie Howe passes the Senate. The Virginia House adopted the bill 60-34 yesterday. The bill has been sent to the Senate, and it remains unclear if it will go to a vote on the floor. Howe says a vote for this bill would be a vote for character. Virginia civil rights groups like the American Civil Liberties Union of Virginia disagree with Howe. Critics of the bill say that this legislation is anti-youth and would encourage racial profiling. Louisiana rejected a similar bill last June. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Selena Masuta of the D.C. Radio Co-op.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Nell Abram.
The New York Times has reported that Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld may pay an official visit to China in an attempt towards revitalizing normal military relations. Such relations were strained after a Chinese jet collided with a U.S. spy plane in 2001. With an increased Chinese military buildup aimed at Taiwan, the article said the Pentagon and the Chinese military are considering to set up an emergency telephone link between the two countries to prevent, quote, misunderstandings. Meanwhile, while China says its economy grew faster in 2004 than in the previous 8 years, a minority of lawmakers on Capitol Hill are calling for a repeal of normal trade relations with China, saying the number one export to that country has been jobs. Mitch Jezerich reports.
Under an authoritarian government that has opened up to free market capitalism, the Chinese economy has grown by almost 20% in the last 2 years. Arguably, some of China's economic success could be credited to normalized trade relations with the United States that began in year 2000. Since that time, the U.S. has amassed a $600 billion trade deficit, which $160 billion of is with China. A minority of lawmakers from both sides of the aisle in the House of Representatives are calling for a repeal of normal trade relations with China. Representative Dana Rohrabacher is a Republican from California.
We use taxpayers' money to guarantee the investment in China so that a company can be set up that is in partnership with the People's Liberation Army. This is insane.
Some estimates project that 630,000 U.S. textile and apparel jobs will be exported to China in less than 2 years, and 1,300 textile plants in the U.S. will close. Though a handful of Republicans support repealing normal trade relations with China, the Republican leadership does not, and the Bush administration has indicated that exporting manufacturing jobs could be good for the economy as the U.S. transforms its workforce to take on high-tech jobs.
It is not acceptable that Bill Gates, the wealthiest man in our country, tells us that a communist authoritarian China has created, quote, a brand new form of capitalism, and as a consumer, it's the best thing that ever happened, end quote.
Independent Representative Bernie Sanders, the only self-proclaimed socialist in Congress from Vermont, introduced a bill that would repeal the 2000 law creating normal relations with China. His bill would impose an average tariff of 45% on Chinese goods entering the country. According to Sanders, it's not just manufacturing jobs that are being outsourced.
Andy Grove, the founder of Intel, predicted last year that the United States will lose the bulk of its information technology jobs to China and India over the next decade. John Chambers, the CEO of Cisco, was typical of many high-tech leaders when he said, and I quote, China will become the IT center of the world. What we, Cisco, are trying to do is outline an entire strategy of becoming a Chinese company, end of quote.
But labor journalist and photographer David Bacon is doubtful that repealing normal trade relations with China would be effective in either keeping jobs in the U.S. or improving conditions for Chinese workers.
Corporations are basically trying to engineer a global race to the bottom in which working people are forced into competition from country to country, and companies move production wherever the wages are lowest and wherever the conditions are worse, wherever there are no unions. And the answer to that really has to be we have to be able to support them to erase that kind of difference in the standard of living that exists between the U.S. and other countries, which is what corporations are taking advantage of.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
Two U.S. soldiers were killed in separate attacks in Iraq today, and gunfire and explosions erupted in central Baghdad. Amidst the violence, a new interim government is beginning to take shape, though it will still be some time before the full results of the election are known. David Enders interviews Adel Abdul-Mehdi, the current Minister of Finance, a member of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and a likely candidate to be the next prime minister.
In a heavily fortified house in Karada, an ethnically and religiously mixed neighborhood in the central part of the capital, Abdul-Mehdi declined to say whether any agreement had been reached concerning posts in the new government. Though Abdul-Mehdi ran with a number of candidates from different parties under the United Iraqi Alliance, or Shiite list, in the national elections, many of the parties ran independently in local elections in the country's 18 governorates.
So we have to see the final results, at least the preliminary results announced officially. And it's also important to see the results of the provincial councils, because they reflect also the presence of each party.
The Election Commission announced this afternoon that the final vote tally would not be announced for at least a few more days, but already it is clear that the United Iraqi Alliance, whose core is comprised of Shiri members, will take at least half the seats in the 275-member National Assembly. It is widely believed that the new prime minister will be a Shiite, the president a Kurd, and the National Assembly speaker, a position of relatively little power in comparison to the other two, will be a Sunnah. Abdul-Mehdi said he has contact with the Council of Islamic Scholars, the most influential group of Sunni clerics in the country, but did not give names or say which other posts Sunnis might be invited to fill.
And it seems to me they are on board. We had very positive message coming from them, encouraging the whole process. And if even differences could be discussed in meetings rather than having opposite attitudes and views.
On the question of U.S. troops, Abdul-Mehdi said it was impossible to give a date for when a pullout might begin, and that it was heavily dependent on rebuilding the country's internal security forces.
We are not opposing to timetables, but let's first of all define conditions so we can later on, objectively speaking, define real timetables when we are prepared to do so. So we have to see conditions of the building up of military forces. Well, you listen to the Ministry of Interior. He was predicting that he needs 18 months to accomplish, and this should be restudied also, more or less, because I think we have to work a lot on the police and on forces within the Ministry of Interior.
In the absence of official security forces, some Shiite groups, including members of the Badr Brigade, Syria's militant wing, have enforced Islamic law, especially in Basra, harassing women who don't cover their heads and burning down liquor stores.
We'll never be able to really stop this. It will show itself one way or another.
Thursday begins the Shiite holiday of Muharram, a 40-day observance during which many liquor store owners say they won't bother opening. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
U.S. mothers who have lost their sons in Iraq and 9/11 recently traveled to the border of Jordan and Iraq with Code Pink and Global Exchange on a mission to deliver $600,000 worth of medical supplies to Iraqi children. Nadia McRoffrey, who lost her son in Iraq, had one more mission, to meet with Iraqi mothers who have also lost their children to war. Mia Kim reports.
Patrick McCaffrey's National Guard unit had not been in overseas combat since World War II. But he was deployed to Iraq in March 2004.
Patrick was not a military person in any way. He reacted, like we all did, to 9/11. And his way of reacting positively to it was to think of joining the National Guard. And he thought that would be a good way to make a difference and help out his country. And he had no intention in going to Iraq.
In June, Patrick McCaffrey was killed in an ambush. In his email to his mother before his death, he expressed how he was ashamed of the U.S. soldiers who were involved in the Abu Ghraib torture, and how it became very hard for soldiers to deal with many Iraqis. Since the day her son died, Nadia McCaffrey's mission has become to stop the war.
I grew up in France, and after the war, my grandfather worked with the resistance, the French resistance. That's exactly what we're doing in Iraq. We are occupying their country. And the people that defend their country, I don't blame.
Her way of bringing peace in Iraq is to meet Iraqi mothers who also lost their children at war.
One of them was Iraqi and young, and she didn't speak to anyone in particular. And she had lost one of her children and one relative of hers, and had very clear resentment toward us. I said to her, I hope that you get to know us better, especially me, because I really want to have you in my life if I can. So you understand maybe why I'm here and what I am fighting for right now, what I would like to see between Iraq and America. I would like to see you to see the real faces of mothers like me, and we want peace. She ended up having tears in her eyes, and I asked her, may I give you a hug? You know, I just said that, and then she just came, and we just kind of stood like this for, I don't know, it seems like a long time. And I could feel her sobbing, you know, from the pain and from the, also the connection.
Nadia McCaffrey is planning to return to the border of Iraq and Jordan within 2 months to start a safe haven for Iraqi mothers and children. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mia Kim.
Nepal's home ministry says it has detained 25 people and are keeping 18 more under house arrest. This after King Gyanendra dismissed his government last week, citing that it had failed to block the Maoist insurgency. The list of those detained and arrested includes student activists and political leaders, and it is suspected that as many as 100 people may have been rounded up. Tanks continue to roam the streets of Nepal cities, and political dissidents are being warned to stay home or face arrest. Joining us to talk about the recent developments in Nepal is Brad Adams, Asia Director of Human Rights Watch. What do we know about these detainees? Are they able to speak with lawyers or family members?
No, they're held completely incommunicado. Even people who are under house arrest are not allowed to have any contact with the outside world. They're not even allowed to read newspapers, watch TV, or listen to the radio. And that's a very conscious decision of the king, and he wants to isolate the political parties and human rights activists and lawyers from the rest of society, believing that they were leading the opposition to his coup.
And we now know that an anti-king rally was scheduled for tomorrow. The king has warned against it, and one of its organizers, Krishna Pahadi, the founding chairman of the Human Rights and Peace Society, was arrested by plainclothes officers. Can we expect that these arrests will stop anytime soon?
That's really not clear. The king has already arrested enough people to send a chill through much of society, but Nepal has a very active, even if it's a small group of human rights activists and human rights defenders and lawyers and journalists, and they're probably not going to be cowed by this, and nor should they be. They have every right to complain about a coup. So the concern really is that the king may escalate this in his attempt to have complete domination of the political scene in Nepal. And if he does, it's going to polarize things even further.
And finally, King Gyanendra says he dismissed his government because of the Maoist insurgency. India last week denounced the king's actions, but are now saying that they will continue to grant Nepal military assistance to stop the Maoists. Why has India decided to ignore this palace coup?
Well, India hasn't ignored it. In fact, for India, it was quite remarkable that they took the first position that they did in condemning it. India tends to believe in non-interference in the internal affairs of other countries. That's been their credo for decades, and that they reacted at all showed that they really thought this was a mistake. They said publicly they thought that this was going to drive people into the hands of the Maoists. You know, just so everyone knows, these Maoists are not some kind of do-gooder lefties. They are very, very violent. They execute what they consider to be class enemies regularly. They abduct people. They have a long history of targeting civilians. It was not easy for India to take this position, because in theory, cutting off arms supplies to the Nepali government could weaken them and pave the way for the Maoists to take power. So what I think India has done is tried to send a very strong signal, but realized when they thought about it that they didn't want the outcome to be a Maoist victory. The problem here is that the king seems to realize that, that all the countries that supply arms, and the main suppliers are India, United States, and Britain, that all of them will choose him over the Maoists when push comes to shove. And so he has played his hand thus far, and now we're waiting to see how others are going to react.
Brad Adams is the Asia Director for Human Rights Watch. He joined us today from London. University Professor Ward Churchill entered a packed-to-capacity auditorium at the University of Colorado last night, accompanied by members of the American Indian Movement. More than 1,200 people filled the hall, while an additional 250 attended a rally outside. Churchill was due to speak on his essay on 9/11, which has drawn fire from many in the media, as well as legislators such as Colorado Governor Bill Owens, who have called on the Board of Regents to dismiss Churchill. This has been seen as a political attack on academic freedom. FSRN's Maeve Conran presents these excerpts from Churchill's remarks at last night's event.
I don't answer to Bill Owens. I don't answer in the sense that they think I do to the Board of Regents. The Board of Regents should do its job and let me do mine.
The essay on 9/11 was written in 2001. It included a reference to some killed in the World Trade Center attacks as Little Eichmanns. Nazi Adolf Eichmann is considered by many to be the architect of the Holocaust. It is this reference which has incensed many. However, Churchill says that the uproar has overshadowed the message, which is that the terrorist attacks were a result of U.S. foreign policy.
Now, I was picking that up on 9/11, basically in stream of consciousness, because they were asking this question, how could this happen? Why do they hate us? And my response is, look at this. How could they not? Every Palestinian child shot in the head for throwing a rock in the Intifada is being shot with munitions provided by the United States. The munitions are fired from a rifle provided by the United States.
Churchill made comparisons between the treatment of Native Americans by the U.S. government and the victims of U.S. foreign policy. In addition to questions surrounding the 2001 essay, Churchill, who is a member of the American Indian Movement, has come under fire from some who allege that he is not of Native American descent.
The issue was not sustainable, so I am to become the issue. Well, later for that. Later for that. My identity does not come from some punk editorial page editor at the Rocky Mountain News or the Boulder Daily Camera.
Churchill's writings are currently under a 30-day review by the Board of Regents, after which the Regents will make a decision on whether he shall remain on the teaching staff. As a tenured professor, however, Churchill is guaranteed academic freedom in his writings. He vows to challenge any attempt to remove him from the faculty in what many see as a battle for academic free speech. For FSRN, this is Maeve Conran in Boulder, Colorado.
Arizona Republican Senator John McCain announced the introduction of the Local Community Radio Act of 2005 yesterday as low-power FM broadcasters gathered at the Federal Communications Commission for a forum to address their ongoing battles to preserve and extend their local signals. In Washington, D.C., Dolores M. Bernal has more.
James Hickman helps to run the low-power community radio station WRIR 97.3 LPFM in Richmond, Virginia. Although the radio station has only been on the air for 40 days, it's already making a big impact, bringing local musicians, activists, and government officials to the airwaves. Hickman's story of why he became involved in the micro-radio movement is a familiar one.
For Richmond, we've lost all of our small local stations. I think we're down to two at this point, and I've just really become disenchanted with the content of the radio and decided to get involved myself.
After the passage of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, there was an increase of ownership consolidation in the radio industry. Throughout the country, media giants such as the conservative Texas-based Clear Channel were given a green light to buy up smaller radio stations. With the average price of $2.5 million to acquire a radio station, community members and activists were worried that diverse views would be denied access. After years of debate and concerns from these media activists, in 2000, the FCC authorized a new affordable community radio service called Low Power FM, or LPFM. LPFM can broadcast only a fraction of what full-power FM stations can, with the average range of 3.5 miles.
Low-power FM truly represents a unique opportunity to give new voice to old communities, and some new communities as well. And so it really holds a special place in our heart.
These words by FCC Commissioner Michael Powell were echoed by many FCC commissioners on Tuesday. Several LPFM providers from around the country appeared before the commission to voice their growing concerns. Harold Kozwolski runs WCNHLP in Concord, New Hampshire.
We received considerable first adjacent interference from one of the most powerful FM stations in North America. Their signal is so strong, there are even places within our city that you cannot receive WCNHLP without significant interference.
Ironically, the issue of signal interference was the pretext brought up by the big broadcasters back in 2000, when Congress was willing to allow licensing to thousands of LPFMs. Clear Channel and even National Public Radio opposed low-power FM, and their claim obligated Congress to enact the Radio Broadcasting Preservation Act. The act restricted the FCC from giving out low-power FM licenses. Federal Communications Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein.
We wish we could do more, but Congress was cautious and said that we're going to restrict you, but we're going to ask for a study. And we did the study, and it turns out that Congress didn't need to be as restrictive as it was. They were responding to allegations that there was a lot of interference to existing commercial broadcasters that, in fact, didn't pan out when we did the study. The problem is now Congress has to go back and undo what it did in order for us to have the flexibility to issue as many licenses as we'd like.
On Tuesday, U.S. Senator John McCain of Arizona introduced a bill called the Local Community Radio Act of 2005. This act seeks to reverse some of those restrictions imposed back in 2000. The bill will face criticism from big broadcasters and their supporters in Congress. Again, FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein.
You could argue, certainly, that commercial broadcasters are concerned about competition for ears. I mean, they want people to be listening to their stations so they get their ratings up, and they don't want community broadcasters that are doing public interest work to detract from the people who are listening to their stations. So certainly there's a competitive reasons that commercial broadcasters wouldn't want more of these LPFM stations to be licensed.
The future of LPFM is still up in the air, with a new FCC chairman to be appointed by the White House after Powell steps down in March. Activists for LPFM are wondering if Tuesday's forum will produce any positive changes. They're optimistic and ready to fight another 5 years if necessary to keep the airwaves open. Dolores Bernal, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica stations WBAI in New York, KPFK in Los Angeles, and KPFA in Berkeley, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. DC editor is Mitch Jezerich. Our technical production team is Jay Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Millen, and Eric Klein. Special thanks to Transbay for web services. For archives of this or other newscasts or documentaries, visit our website, www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.